I still remember where I was the first time it hit me. I maybe do have ADHD. And it's funny, I posted a TikTok the other day about having ADHD, and a good friend of mine texted me and said, "Remember when you swore to me you didn't have ADHD?" Oh, goodness. Well, listen, if you relate to that at any point in your life, I want to share a podcast that you should tune into. It's called ADHD Aha, hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. In each episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways that ADHD symptoms can surface for adults. And it doesn't always look the way we thought it would. So check it out. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha, with Aha spelled A-H-A. Hello, you sentient ball of stardust. This is Struggle Care, the podcast about self-care by a host that hates the term self-care. And we're going to get into that today. I have a guest today named Amanda Dodson. She is a therapist and a professional organizer. And you know me, I love that combination. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Casey. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Amanda, the reason I wanted to have you on is because I love your take on things as a person who basically talks about low energy care of self. So will you sort of orient our readers as to why that sort of became a place for you and what your background is?
Yeah. So I started my career as a community social worker. So I did in-home therapy for families who had cases open with child protective services, basically. And a lot of those cases were for what they called condition of the home. So our job would be to go in. And I mean, purportedly, our job was to help them get the house cleaned up. But really, what it was figuring out what had gotten in the way of them being able to care for their home and sometimes care for their children and themselves. And often it was physical disability, it was significant mental illness, or simply not having been raised with that set of skills in getting to adulthood and just not being sure quite what to do. And so I really found I had a passion for just really getting in there and kind of getting my hands dirty to get homes the way people wanted them to be, with the sort of like mental health spin on it. And I moved into like different areas of practice after that. But then during COVID, I myself developed a chronic illness that really impacted my ability to do all of the like cleaning and organizing that I loved to do. So it was necessary for me to really adjust my habits and my expectations about how to keep up with caring for myself, caring for the people I take care of also, because I'm also a caretaker for other people who are chronically ill, and keeping up with just like the daily work of running a home, which is a lot when you've got other stuff going on.
So what would you say was the hardest like shift mentally to make when you found yourself with a smaller capacity of energy than you were used to?
I think the hardest thing to accept for me was just that it was simply not possible for me to do it all in the way that I was used to being able to do. Like in the past, and lots of people who have like become disabled know this journey, but in the past, you're used to having a pretty much infinite supply of energy, even if it is hard to reach sometimes. And it really took me a while to accept, like, I just cannot do that anymore. And so I can't count on being able to like wake up on a Saturday morning and clean my whole house for the day, for the week. I have to be planful about how I ration my energy. And even in things like taking care of myself, getting myself showered, hair washed, dressed every single day, like, that became something I had to spend my energy on rather than something that was just a given that I would be able to do.
It's interesting. You know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with spoon theory, but probably not everybody is, which is this idea that, well, here, I'll let you explain it. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, spoon theory. So the idea is that when you're able-bodied, able-minded, you have a pretty much endless supply of these little spoonfuls of energy. Like if you imagine you're physical and mental energy as a big jar. You can just like spoon out of it and the spoons never stop coming. But when you have depression or you have chronic pain or something interfering, your spoons are finite. And sometimes they're extremely finite, like you only have a couple a day. So you have to be really careful about how you spoon out your energy.
Well, and it's a really helpful metaphor for understanding like just the idea of having a limited capacity, which I find is applicable to most people. So I don't have a chronic illness, but what I found was when I went from having one kid to having two kids and then going through the pandemic and then like coming under some stress, all of a sudden I was experiencing this thing where I would wake up and I would have these things I needed to get done that day. And then like suddenly at 3 p.m., I would just hit a wall. And it was like, I could feel my body and my mind being like, powering down.
Yes.
And I'd be like, oh my, and I could not get myself to do anything else. I'd have brain fog, I'd have fatigue, and it was really frustrating. And especially, you know, then it's, but it's like, oh God, I have all these other things, including like getting my kids into bed and feeding myself and like this thing that has to happen tomorrow. And so I think like whether it is chronic illness or you mentioned mental illness or just burnout or stress, or I know a lot of parents, or maybe you got a new dog. I mean, literally whatever it is, we go through this thing where we're going, oh my God, why don't I have the limitless energy that I had before? And I think that a lot of people are, I mean, even able-bodied people have to make choices. Like maybe they don't have the energy for everything, but typically they have enough energy to cover all of the necessities. And they're really only making cuts when it comes to the extra. So it's like, I'm too tired to go to the beach and do a 3-mile run today. So I guess I'll have to pick one, right? But it's like very different when that energy runs out at, okay, I guess I have to decide whether I'm going to shower today or I'm going to clean my house.
Yes, yes. Or whether I'm going to shower or be able to prepare myself a dinner, right? Like, but isn't it interesting what I heard you say, and I totally identify with this, like when you hit that wall and kind of ran out of spoons, our emotional reaction is to feel frustrated and angry. And sometimes, and often like angry at ourselves, like, why am I so tired right now? Like, what am I doing wrong? Did I not drink enough water? Did I not get enough sleep? Like, why do I feel this way? It must be something that I've done. And I just have found that to be so counterproductive, even though it's our regular response, because it only tires us out more to be angry and frustrated with ourselves for feeling tired.
Yeah, it was a huge deal for me to be like, okay, especially in my case, like I didn't know why I was running out of energy. I didn't know if it was the trauma from the pandemic, if I had something wrong with my hormones, if I was sick, if I was depressed, like what it was. And I was kind of frustrated that my doctors kept being like, I mean, you might just be traumatized. So it's like, no, it must be something fixable. But like getting to the point where I hit that wall and instead of launching into those questions or those criticisms, just being like, okay, this is where it ends for me today. Like, it's, I think, a hard transition to be okay with those stopping points and a kind of a non-judgmental awareness.
Totally. And like radical acceptance is the name of the game, because it's natural for us to go into that like question spiral of why we're tired or why we're out of juice. But like that only just creates more suffering and more fatigue. And it's a lot more effective, I've found, to just be like, well, that's it for today. That's all Amanda has to spend. So we got to redirect into something else.
Well, what I love about your channel on TikTok and about the kind of services that you offer is that coming into it from a place of knowing what it's like to have to ration energy and even mental and physical energy kind of allows you to think outside the box. Right. And I think that a lot of resources and services out there about home care, about self-care, they kind of come from an able-bodied perspective. Right. So it's more about, you know, putting all of the different glass jars into the pantry or having your rainbow colored bookcase and meal prepping big, huge meals that you know you're going to have the time and energy to plan on Sundays and those sort of things. And I have an example of one that I love that I've always loved. I'm going to play
Hey, you. If you're too hungry and dysregulated to figure out what you want to eat, so you just eat nothing, eat a little snack first. Wait for a minute, then figure out what you want to make yourself for a meal. Snack before a meal is allowed. Do it. Okay, love you.
I love this because it's those types of little tips that are counterintuitive in a lot of ways. Like, they're so simple when you hear them, and it reveals to us all of these like rules about caring for ourselves that we're like kind of following. Like, who would have thought I felt like I wasn't allowed to eat a snack before deciding on a larger meal?
Yes, but we carry those rules with us. You'd be shocked how many comments from people were like, why did I never think that this was okay? And I think I've like worked in eating disorder recovery too professionally. So like the food thing has a special place in my heart. But yeah, I mean, I think we carry a lot of rules that come from just like gender expectations and role expectations about like how we're supposed to clean our home, live in our home, eat in our home. And they are pretty aimed towards someone who's already doing quite well at all of those things. So the advice doesn't end up being that helpful.
So how many people do you work with on like a coaching basis that come to you because they've tried some other like self-care organization method, and it was a method made for someone who is firing on all able-bodied, able-minded, totally great support system cylinders?
I mean, like all of them, all of them, every single one. Yeah, I was just talking to one of my coaching clients the other day, and they were saying like, yeah, I looked up methods for like a system for cleaning my house. And it was like, day two, remove everything from your cabinets and wipe them out. Day three, clean all the baseboards. And they were like, this is intermediate. I need beginner. Like, I'm nowhere near keeping up this level of cleanliness. I need something so much more simple. And really what people need is like the kind of home care training that some of us receive as kids on how to keep up with homes, but a lot of people just don't for whatever reason.
So I want to, in just a minute, I want to get into something that you said where you talked about how a lot of the guilt or shame we feel or the messages about like what rules we're allowed to break come from these different cultural expectations. I want to get into that, but I'm going to pause for a second and then we will be right back.
A few weeks ago, my husband's beloved grandfather died, and it's been a really sad time for our whole family. But one of the moments of light in this whole process was shortly after he passed away, I got an email from my mother-in-law, and she had sent all of us a link to his StoryWorth book. I don't know if you're familiar with StoryWorth, but I have a new appreciation for them now that we have a StoryWorth book on my husband's grandfather. Here's how it works. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. StoryWorth makes the writing process a breeze. All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. Long or short, it doesn't matter. And then you get emailed a copy of their response as they're submitted in the course of a year. You'll get to enjoy the retelling of their stories that you already know or be surprised by stories you've never heard before. And after that year of fun, StoryWorth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. I am so grateful to my mother-in-law for doing this with her dad. We love it. Families love StoryWorth. That's why it has more than 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, with millions of stories preserved since they were founded over 10 years ago. So Mother's Day is coming up, and I want to give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you will cherish for years. Right now, save 10% on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/struggle. That's StoryWorth.com/struggle to save $10 on your first purchase. Whether it's Mother's Day, Father's Day, or just because you know that sometimes time is short and you want to capture those memories. Hey, if you enjoyed my episode on IEPs and you want to listen to more podcast episodes about IEPs, I want to tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season, the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ertube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs.
You might have heard me talk about IEPs on my episode, and this latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. I checked out these episodes, and I think that they are a great place for you to go after listening to mine. They go into a little more detail and answer a little more in depth about what an IEP is and whether your child needs one. So listen to Understood Explains by searching for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. Okay, we are back with Amanda Dodson, who is a counselor and a professional organizer. She runs her company called Nesting Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. You could tell I was worried that I'd forgotten it. So we're talking about how when you go through something and you find yourself with a much more limited capacity than you previously had, and sort of almost, would you say there's almost like a like phases of grief that you go through, of like coming to terms with being able to be non-judgmental about the fact that you have to now budget things differently?
Yes, totally. And I really experienced this myself, and I've seen other people go through it, where it's almost like you have to mourn the death of your able-bodied self. That like they might not be coming back. You're going to have a different kind of life now. And I think that comes with the whole process of accepting like a chronic problem or a chronic disability, or even just like a chronic life challenge. Like from now on, you're going to have to be taking care of your ill parent, or from now on, your child has a special need that you never expected to parent, but now you gotta, right? Like we all have these things come up in our lives that are unexpected, that we never planned for.
It's almost like chronic lack of support also is,
yes,
a huge one, right? Like there are people out there that didn't plan to be single parents.
Exactly.
They didn't plan for their job to transfer them away from their family. They didn't plan to suddenly lose their job and now have to spend so much more time making the amount of support that they used to have, and now they're exhausted and limited in time and energy.
Yes. And all the narratives we have for how to deal with that are very, I mean, you're from Texas like I am, so we were steeped in like, just sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, like, just, you know, get it together, and then everything will be okay, and you'll be able to handle all of it. And I think people feel quite full of despair when that doesn't work, because the opposite is true. Like in those times of your life when you're accepting that you have to ration your energy, that's when you need the most support. And that's when you need to be bringing in more people that you didn't expect to help you out, but now they do.
And we were sort of talking briefly about the idea that most like home and self-care advice is sort of almost geared towards people that have able-bodied and support systems. I'm curious your thoughts on why that is. Because if you think about it, like people who need quote unquote self-help advice are people that need help, right? And so, and yet most of the sort of self-help advice out there is really only geared towards a specific like demographic of people that don't actually need too much help.
Yes. And I think it's because those are the people that can afford to buy the books. Those are the people that have the disposable income for those sorts of things. And that's why, I mean, I love your book, and I love writing for the target audience of people that it's like, maybe you're not going to be able to read this whole book. Maybe you're just going to be able to skim it. Maybe you're going to be able to get some snippets from the internet, right? Like, I don't know why self-help advice is so written towards basically well people who just want to like be a little bit better. But I think it's just because people like they forget they exist until they're one of them or they're taking care of one of them.
Yeah, the world doesn't really like to pretend like disabled people exist in their full rights as autonomous human beings that are experiencing life still.
Yes.
And I mean, I think you brought up a great point, which is that the majority of self-help products and advice is living in a capitalistic market where they want people to purchase that product. And so you need to both promise to fix somebody's all their problems, and you need to be aiming and marketing in a way that people that have expendable income want to be marketed to. Right? They want to believe that all they have to do is just believe in themselves and manifest, and then, you know, this will all be fit, like they'll be better. they'll suddenly have more energy. They'll get everything done. Everything will look nice. That's unfortunate, but it's so true. But I think it's helpful to know that when we're hearing messages like motivational speakers and people selling books and things like that. At the end of the day, they're trying to get people to purchase from them. And you have to market in that way.
Yeah. Like, it's a product. And yeah. But the products are sometimes packaged so seductively. Like, the idea that if you could just do this one thing, follow this one cleaning system, or make this one little thinking change in your life, and then like, everything would be great and nothing would be difficult or confusing ever again. Like, what a dangerously seductive idea. But that's not actually how life works. It's really more complex than that. And you can do all the right things and still have something bad happen to have everything thrown off the rails.
So when you work with someone who is trying to, let's say, create a more functional home or work some self-care, I love how many tips you have about eating. Because if you go and look for like tips on eating well, it's mostly like diet advice.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
But my experience is like, there's a lot of people who are just like, no, how do I eat like anything?
Yeah. It's one of the first questions that I ask people, even when they come to me for just like cleaning or organization, like, what's your eating routine like? Because I find especially neurodivergent people, I think because just their internal clocks run a little bit differently, like they tend to eat nothing all morning, some of the afternoon until like 3 o'clock, they realize they're like starving. And that's when their brain tells them you're hungry. But by that time, they've lost all executive functioning skills to be able to prepare a meal. And usually they've lost all connection with their like hunger fullness cues. So it's just sort of like, I need to get something in my body right now. And then the meal doesn't end up even being that enjoyable because it's eaten sort of frantically. And then they don't get hungry again until like late at night, when ideally it would be time to like wind down a little bit and start thinking about going to sleep. And if you can run your life on that schedule, am I calling you out right now, Casey?
Oh my God, you're literally describing my exact day. Like, oh my gosh, I feel exposed.
And that's the reaction that people typically have is like, how did you know?
I mean, the more I talk to people, the more I'm convinced I've never had a unique experience. Okay, so if I come to, let's go with that. Like, let's say I come to you and I'm like, hey, and you describe that and I go, oh my God, that's me. And I'm like, oh, but I want to organize my house. Why is it though that you ask that first and we're going to start there?
Because they're never going to have the executive functioning to organize their house if they're starving.
So what are some things that you would suggest to me if I were to say like, yes, that's my eating pattern and I'm going offline at 3 p.m. and I feel this paralysis and I'm panic eating, but I don't know what to make myself. Like, where do we start with some tips for that?
Well, I mean, usually I try to target lunch because breakfast is really hard for people. So I'll have people set an alarm for lunch. And we'll make them a list of things to, like, ideally that day when I meet with them, go to the store and buy things that they know they like that are really quick, they can just grab out of the fridge for a lunch. Then we start to target breakfast. And it's like, when you get up in the morning, a lot of people don't feel like eating, but it's like, what's the least, like, horrifying thing you can think of nourishing yourself with in the morning? Can you get through a like Luna bar, right? Could you tolerate like a piece of toast with some peanut butter on it or something like that, right? And most people find once they start eating more regularly, they're more in touch with their hunger fullness cues. And so they remember to eat more frequently because they're starting to notice when they're actually hungry. So yeah, alarms, having snacks in every room of the house is sometimes something that's worked for some people, like just having them visible.
That has been huge for me. I started keeping peanut butter crackers on my third floor. So my office is on the third floor of our house. And I found myself, like, even when I was recognizing I was hungry, not wanting to go down to the first floor.
Yeah.
And I spent several days being like, but you have to, Casey, make yourself, you have to, it's important. Before I was like, or just put some peanut butter crackers on the third floor. Like, maybe this is a battle for another day.
Yes. Yes. Because way better peanut butter crackers than like nothing and internal turmoil.
Right.
Yeah.
And so do clients push back on you when you say get something you can just grab? Because that probably means things that are prepackaged, things that are wrapped in plastic. Do you ever have people say like, oh God, no, the environment, like I can't do it?
Yeah, I do. I get the environment and I get the the food rules around like, but that's processed food and I should be eating something with a vegetable. And I'm like, you're not eating anything, baby. Like, like, come on, don't be a hero.
I loved the one you did where you were like acting out a skit and you said, oh, I've really got to get all this homework done. But, you know, I'm hungry and I'm thirsty and I'm starving, but I've got to get this homework done. And you were like, okay, well, why do you need to get the homework done? They're like, so I can get a good job. And why do you need a good job? So that I can live a fulfilling life. Okay, like, is this fulfilling? Are you feeling fulfilled? And you're like, no, I'm not. I'm hungry. And they're like, okay, you have to eat if you want to do these other things. Like, not eating is not in alignment with your long-term goals.
It is not.
I love that. Okay, so that's pretty good. So let's say that I get the eating down. I'm starting to eat regular meals and I've learned to maybe eat a snack before I make a meal, get some prepackaged things. If I'm feeling like my house isn't functional, where's a place that you like to start with people? Especially if they're going, the amount of things that needs to be done for my home to be functional. So, because a lot of my wording is about just focus on function, just focus on function. Like, don't worry about it being perfect, focus on function. And that's really helpful for a huge demographic that listens to me and listens to my content, it sets them free. But a lot of times what happens is people going, okay, but like my capacity is such that like I don't even have the energy to get it functional. Where do I go from there?
Yeah. So the first question I usually ask at that point is, what is the most distressing area of your home that's always in your way? It's always causing a problem for you. When you look at it, you're filled with despair. Like, what is that? For every person, it's different. Sometimes it's like, oh, my bathroom. Or for a lot of people, it's the sink with the dishes. And so then we start to, but then they'll say, but it's so overwhelming, I can't even think of where to start. So we'll say, okay, what would be the very, very first step to doing the dishes? And they'll start to go like, well, you know, they'll go like six steps in and I'm like, no, back it up. You just maybe open the dishwasher and see if there's clean dishes in there. Maybe we just empty the sink so we can work in it, right? And like, I find that once people get that first step going, it's like it breaks the avoidance seal that their brain has imposed and they can actually engage in the task without feeling overwhelmed.
I found that I have to put on an apron.
Oh,
that's like my game changer. If I put on an apron and put on music, then I'm like, okay, maybe I can open the dishwasher.
Now I am cleaning person. Yes. Yeah, totally. And like, a lot of people, through talking with them, we find that they have some sort of like sensory aversion to the task that is causing a problem with them. We need to put an accommodation in place to help it be less distressing. So sometimes we problem solve that. And sometimes they just need permission to start small. So I'll ask them like, how long do you think you could clean your house for today? And they'll say like an hour. And so I'll say like, okay, set a timer for 7 minutes and just clean.
Thank you for saying that. I was really hoping that you were going to say that, because the amount of times that I have gone to like a professional, whether it's a dietitian or a therapist or whatever, and been like, I mean, I think I could do like, you know, 30 minutes a day. And they'll be like, excellent, we're going to start with three.
Yes.
Like, I always overestimate what I think I can commit to. And then I'm too overwhelmed to do it. So I'm so glad to hear that that's what you do with people.
Yes.
But it's so true, because we need the experience of being successful to feel motivated to do it again. Like, I can't be like shooting for 30 minutes multiple days and not making it and like want to keep doing that.
Totally. Yeah. And that trick works for a lot of things. Like, for me, I like my cognitive energy like hits a wall at some point in the day and I just don't have any more like focus anymore. So one way I ration that, if I need to like write an article, get work done, I'll be like, okay, I can't say sit down and write an article, but I can say sit down and I'm going to set a timer for 3 minutes and I'll write during those 3 minutes. And like, what I find and what a lot of people find is like, just once they do that 3 minutes, they're like, wow, I did it. Success. And usually they want to keep going.
I love that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, I want to ask you more about the sensory issues. One of the most exciting things about getting our puppy Luna was getting all of the things together, getting the toys and the bed and the little skates, just envisioning that life that I was going to have with that cute little puppy. And if you're getting a pet soon, that means that you need to start thinking about the necessities, not just food and toys and a bed, something that you may not be thinking about, like pet insurance, which is why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care that they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. You use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly to your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/struggle. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/struggle. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independent American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back. And I want to dive into this idea of people having sensory barriers, because I feel like, you know, when I am struggling to get something done in my home or take care of myself, it's often like the first thought is like, oh, I'm such a piece of junk. Like, I just have to try harder. I have to do that. And when we give people permission to believe that their struggle with a care task is morally neutral, that like it doesn't mean anything about them and that their barriers are legitimate, I have found that that cracks open all of this problem solving. Like, I can't tell you the amount of people who, when I talk about like brushing teeth, and I'll say like some people don't like, they're avoiding brushing their teeth. And I ask like, why? And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, why? But like, think about, like, really think about like what it is that, and people really haven't given themselves permission to think about what they hate about it so much, because they think that their avoidance of it is such a character failing. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about how you walk through sensory issues and like, what does that mean? What does that entail? What are some of the most common ones you've seen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, teeth brushing is a huge one, because for some people, the toothbrush and the taste of the toothpaste is a sensory nightmare. I've worked in like therapeutic schools with kids that are on the autism spectrum. And one school that I worked at in Boston, they had a whole OT department, just like they had a therapy department. They had an entire gym in a department of OTs. And I'm like, I love OT. Like, I should have gone to school to be an OT. I'm into it. But I was so inspired by all the strategies that they had. And I started to realize how many sensory issues I had in my own life that I had just sort of like shoved down in a little ball because they seemed weird, or like, as my parents would say, like, you're a funny girl. Like, just the nicest way to say, like, that's really strange. But I like, for myself, I started noticing like I was avoiding washing my Tupperware. At times I would even just throw it away because old food gave me like a full body, just ick nausea reaction. Like I couldn't think about touching it. I couldn't think about even looking at it, smelling it. And so actually at work, a dietitian saw me throw it away and she was like, okay, I'm going to work with you on this, even though you're my coworker. She was like, you're going to open it, put it in the sink, run hot water in it and soap so that you can't see all the food right away. And we're just going to get like all the bad stuff down the drain, and you're going to put gloves on. Right. And so like giving myself permission to think about this, not as just like a funny quirk that I had, but as like a genuine functional issue, was really illuminating. And so, I mean, the most common ones I hear are like touching old wet food, and people often need like gloves, a drop of like something that smells good under the nose to be able to smell something different. Another one people have is like they just hate the feeling of wet hands. So gloves also work with that, but also aprons, like sweatbands that go on their wrists. The water can't run down the wrist. That helps with face washing too, because a lot of people avoid washing their faces because of the drips. A lot of people have, and I have this one, like if there's like crunchy things underfoot when I'm walking around the house barefoot, it like makes me want to implode. And so I have lots of nice socks, and I asked and asked my friends and family, and eventually they gifted me with one of those little robot vacuums, which has massively improved my quality of life because I'm not just like inundated with horrible sensory input all the time. So
I'm such an apron girl. Like I found that the point of like, I knew that the point of an apron was like to keep things off of your like clothes. But I realized that one of the reasons why I would avoid doing dishes is because when water gets on the sink and I lean up against it, I have like a real thing with wet clothes in any capacity. And so I was like, oh, that's why people wear aprons. I mean, to me, an apron was such a 1950s thing.
Yeah.
So when I recognize like the functionality of not only does it like get me in the headspace, but like when I have gloves on, when I have an apron on, when I have music on, like when I'm addressing my sensory environment, it's amazing to me how much of a task feels intolerable because of the sensory components. And when I address that, all of a sudden the motivational blocks are a little bit less because, oh, it's not as intolerable. And then if you just combine that with a few things, like you said, with like, let me just set a timer for 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of get this like wraparound holistic approach to it.
Yes.
And it's huge. It's a huge deal.
Oh, totally. And the like motivation pairing of like music or podcast or audiobook with the chore is a real game changer for a lot of people. Also, because a lot of people, especially with dishes, the sound of like the dishes knocking together really, really bothers them. So yeah, I mean, I think it's all about like figuring out your special formula for like what makes a chore tolerable. Because once it's tolerable, it's most people find they're even like happy to be able to do it.
And it's such a message of compassion to talk about that with people, because I think a lot of us got this message that if you don't like something, if it's uncomfortable, if you're feeling a sense of like avoidance or even revulsion at doing something, that the only solution to that is just knock it off. Quit being so sensitive, pick yourself up by the bootstraps. Big girls do hard things. And I believe that there is a time and place for believing, hey, this is uncomfortable, but I have to make myself do it anyways. But it's not dishes, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's okay to make a care task that you struggle with a little bit easier, right? With some accommodations. Like the things in my life that I've had to actually tell myself, I know it's uncomfortable, but you have to just do it. They're almost always emotional things, right? Like I need to say this hard thing to a friend. Mm-hmm. I need to, you know, be honest with someone. I need to tell my husband something that's embarrassing. I need to stand up for myself. Like things where it's like, this is going to be hard, but I just have to make myself do it because I have to be courageous. Like that to me is the place for, all right, suck it up, do it. Not, you know, laundry is miserable because like, it's okay. Like it's morally neutral to build in some accommodations around laundry so you don't hate it so much.
Exactly. And like, I mean, I don't mean to get so existential about these things, but like dishes, laundry, cooking, these things are the work of living. Like we spend so much of our lives doing these things. And I hate for people to feel like it's just like something, some burdensome task that they have to do, because, and like also, you know, caring for self and hygiene, right? Like, I think people feel really filled with like emptiness when they think I have to spend my life doing all of these things that are such a burden and I really hate, because we have to do them every day. And if you are burdened by these tasks every day, I mean, how does that make you feel about your life and life in general? And so if we can find a way to make these tasks not only tolerable, but rewarding and pleasant and like a feeling of success and investment in just the life you're living, I do think that it just makes life a lot more meaningful.
Well, and it makes me think, like, for the majority of history, at least in the U.S., with our current country, the majority of domestic care tasks have been left to women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there's, like, some real misogyny behind this idea that, you know, it's silly or it's superficial to spend time making care tasks more enjoyable or easier, that you should just suck it up and do it. Like, just be an adult. Everyone has to do these things. And I always say, like, and sometimes people will say that to me, where I'll talk about a hack that I use and they'll say, it would have taken you 2 seconds longer to just put your dish in the dishwasher, right? And it always makes me think about how, like, there are people that are paid like six-figure salaries to find ways to shave 2 seconds off of production times and warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't think Amazon's paying people like millions of dollars to shave seconds here, seconds there? I mean, we know they don't necessarily care about like worker experience, but when it, you know what I mean? Like, making things more efficient, more doable, more productive. It's like our culture says it's okay to spend a lot of time and energy figuring out how to make business more productive, more efficient. But if you want to take that same type of creativity and dedication to your home, to your self-care, to your home care, figuring out how to create a home that serves you, all of a sudden it's, why would you do that? It's not that deep.
Yeah. Yeah.
When, like you said, like, good bit of living is these care tasks. So it is that deep.
It is that deep. But I think you're right. It's our own internalized misogyny and society's misogyny that makes us see these things as frivolous. And, you know, even like for a lot of history, white women were able to like outsource these tasks to Black, Indigenous, and women of color. So seeing, and I even like experienced this sometimes as someone who internally, as someone who's like, I went and like did all the loans to get this advanced degree and like worked really hard to get this therapy license. And I've found myself like cleaning people's houses. And sometimes I feel a twinge of like, it's uncomfortable to tell people that I'm cleaning instead of practicing therapy, because cleaning is like this not as good like occupation. When in reality, like, a lot of times I'm making people's day better in the same way that I am as a therapist when I go and just clean up their houses for them. I think those forces are really sneaky. Plus, you know, like we were talking about the sensory issues people earlier and giving themselves permission. I know with a lot of men that I work with and men in my life who they had no permission to feel that they had an internal barrier to housework, either from executive functioning or never being taught. A lot of boys are never taught how to care for themselves or their homes. We just assume they'll like figure it out or someone else will do it for them. And I think that's at the point at which it's very seductive for men to kind of like float into the like casual misogyny of like, oh, my sister will just handle it, or my mom will, or my wife will just handle it. And like, I see part of my work as like pulling men out of that to be like, no, let's figure out what's getting in the way of you actually doing these tasks so that you can also participate in the work of living in your home and not just feel like this is some silly thing that's just done for you. Like, you live there. And so you should be a part of it.
Well, and I think it comes down at the end of the day to that every person deserves to function and they deserve help with tasks, even if they seem simple, even if they seem like nobody else needs help with those tasks, because also they do, right? Like, there's a reason why my platform got so big. There's a reason why people come to you and you continue to be able to sustain yourself with this line of work, is because there are people that need help with, how do I feed myself? How do I brush my teeth more regularly? How do I get a functional home that's a little more organized? And so I think what you do is really valuable work, and I really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
Of course. Can you tell everybody where they can find you if they want to follow you?
You can find me on TikTok at Nesting Your Life, and you can find my website at nestingyourlife.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down.
Or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.